Join us in a world where you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Sit back as we discuss hard-won lessons from the best and brightest that the personal defense and competition shooting industry has to offer. Let us help you help yourself, no matter where you are in your personal path. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by LuckyGunner.com and Federal Premium Ammunition. They paid for this, so you don't have to. Now here's your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by LuckyGunner.com and Federal Premium Ammunition. They paid for this, so you don't have to. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at BallisticRadio.com. Get the latest behind-the-scenes info, arguments, photos, videos, class listings, tales of high adventure, memes, other things at Facebook.com/BallisticRadio. Hey, Joe.
I want to know more about these tales of high adventure.
Occasionally cool things happen to me.
So occasionally?
Actually, so it's funny. I will talk with folks that are not in this even a little bit. And, you know, they ask about like what I did for work or what I didn't do for work or something like that. And it's like, oh, I flew to Texas and then drove halfway across the state. Or like, oh, I got to jump out of airplanes with the U.S. Army parachute team or whatever it is. And they're like, wow, that's really cool. And I'm like, that is really cool. I'm really lucky. So thanks, everyone, for letting me do what I do. But hey, guess what?
What's that?
This segment is also brought to you by Lucky Gunner and Federal Premium Ammunition. Whether there was a firefight or you do, in fact, want to worry about that little guy, you need more ammo. And when it's time to restock, you can't beat Federal Premium Ammunition at LuckyGunner.com. With a shipping department that's always moving at 88 miles per hour, if I order a case of American Eagle from Lucky Gunner on a Thursday, it's at my doorstep ready to shoot before the weekend starts. Head to LuckyGunner.com today to check out their in-stock lineup of Federal Premium Ammunition. Remember, unless you're on fire or drowning or some other set of circumstances that I have not considered, perhaps you need new shocks in your vehicle and the weight was just too much for it to bear, you can never really have too much ammo. So joining us, I am very, very happy to welcome back onto the show, Mass Ayoub. Mass, how's it going?
Going good, John. How about y'all?
Oh, man, I am living the dream. I am living the dream. How about you? How are you and Gail doing?
We are doing great. Currently in Orlando, Florida. She's taking a WordPress nerd thing that you would understand, but I would not. I'm out hanging out with the cops.
Well, hey, it sounds like good times, man. So I can't imagine anyone listening to the show doesn't know who you are, but just real quick, who are you and what do you do?
Well, I've been in the game for a while, writing for gun magazines since 1971, teaching police since 1972, and private citizens since 1981. About 40 years now as handgun editor for a guns magazine, and write for various other publications, 20 or so books.
Nice. So you've got quite a bit of experience in all this, and specific to what we're going to be talking to today, you have also done quite a bit of expert witness work, specifically on the on shootings. So you've seen more than the average bear as far as all this stuff goes.
Well, I've been doing the expert witness thing for about 40 years. Studying armed encounters for longer than that.
Perfect. Well, so here's a question that I have that is very, you know, I don't think it's talked about a lot, but sort of is in the front or back of a lot of people's mind, depending on whatever current events are going on. But a lot of folks have this idea of the typical self-defense shooting. You know, the idea seems to be typical self-defense shooting is produce a pistol, carry it on your person, fire three shots at 3 yards in 3 seconds, and that handles a lot of problems. But not all self-defense shootings look that way, and I kind of like to talk about some of the, I'm not going to say atypical instances, but maybe the scenarios, the real-world scenarios that don't get as much attention, and whether or not you could speak to those, and if there's anything you had observed or any specific cases that you were aware of that sort of highlight some trends that are not often discussed.
Well, when you look at it in the overview, the use of the gun in self-defense is an aberration of the norm in a civilized society. If you're experiencing such a situation, you're experiencing a severe deviation from the odds. You cannot then presume that you'll get a statistically average deviation of the norms. You'll see them ranging from muzzle contact to, good heavens, one San Antonio police officer had to engage successfully with a pistol at slightly over 100 yards. A few years ago, we had a 60-something gentleman in a small town in Texas saved the life of a police officer who was shooting it out with a mass murderer. The killer had just murdered some people in a trailer park. The first responding officer was also the sole responding officer to get to the scene in time. And he came under fire from the assailant, who was behind a big tree with a 30-30 rifle. The officer took cover with his .223 AR-15 behind his patrol car. And basic rule of life, 30 caliber rifle bullets are much more likely to punch through patrol car auto bodies than .223 bullets are to punch through heavy trees. 90 degrees off at an angle, this gentleman saw that he was 60-some yards away, opened fire with his Colt Python 357 Magnum revolver, shot the bad guy down, and when the guy fell out from behind his cover, the police sergeant who had responded was able to finish him. And basically, he was credited with having saved the officer's life, having stopped a murder spree, and was given a complimentary AR-15 by the governor of Texas. So the 3 yards thing is kind of optimistic.
Right.
Our colleague Tom Givens has studied approaching 70 now of his private citizen graduates who've been in shooting incidents. And he's had them as far out as 22, 23 yards. Although he found the average of all of them was about one car length.
Right.
So a lot of it's going to depend on, first, how alert you were. As you know, all of us who teach armed self-defense teach the concept of the constant alertness, the relaxed alertness, and having the strong mental plan that when you get the danger signals, you'll respond appropriately. That is probably extending the distance for the trained, committed armed defender compared to the one who's got his head in his butt and his nose in his iPhone and doesn't realize he's in trouble until the mugger's on top of him.
So, and that's actually an interesting point that maybe people don't consider is that if it goes to guns, clearly de-escalation avoidance, that is what anyone in their right mind wants to have the outcome be. No one wants it to go to guns. No reasonable, sane human being wants it to go to guns. But if it goes to guns, let's say that is beyond your control, the more awareness you have, the more likely it is that if it goes to guns, it goes to guns further away than it would have if you were caught completely off guard.
That's true, and the history of it is that time and distance will almost always favor the trained defender.
Right.
The bad news is the attacker is the actor. He gets to make the first move. He's decided what's going to happen and when. We are the reactors. That's why the criminal can put on his gun only when he intends to use it. And we have to have it on all the time because we don't know when or where that attack will come. The one thing we have going for us, the bad guy probably has more experience with this than we do, and for the armed citizen, it may well be their first time having to actually draw on someone else. What a whole lot of folks miss is that if you have seen it coming in time, you get your gun out and on him before he gets his weapon out on you. The history of virtually every large-scale study of this has been that it generally ends there and the bad guy either flees or surrenders to a citizen's arrest. What people miss, because the gun has been made into an icon of violence by the news media and certainly the entertainment media, is the great power of the gun is not so much its power to kill as its power to deter. But the irony of that is that the power to deter draws, obviously, from the power to kill. And the individual who draws that gun has to know absolutely in their heart that they are prepared to pull the trigger if they must. But if they must, they can make the shot, that they can get the hit where it counts, and stops violent action on the part of the assailant. So the irony is those who are prepared to do it are less likely to have to.
Well, and
altogether, too many people miss that.
Yeah. Yes, they do. And even people inside of this seem to miss that pretty often. Let me ask you this. So right now we're talking about armed encounters in public, and oftentimes people do not like to consider that trouble doesn't always find us in public. It can find us other places as well. And a lot of the conversations that the community has in general, especially when we talk about like armed citizen encounters, they focus specifically on the handgun, and because that's what we can carry with us, you know, at all times, if we make the decision to do that. And you know, I'm not going to try and make decisions for everyone else. I carry one all the time. I see good reasons to do that. I recommend that, you know, if you're interested in this and your lifestyle supports it, and that you do so as well. But at the end of the day, I'm not going to tell people what underwear to wear. I'm not going to tell people, you know, what very impactful decisions they should make. But something that I think I'd like to talk about with you is it's not always a handgun, is it?
No, particularly in the home defense context, the shotgun and the rifle have often been used. And again, we've seen an interesting thing with the AR-15. The gun has become, of course, the lightning rod for the whole anti-gun movement. And one thing a whole lot of people are missing, when the other guy realizes I've broken into a house and someone's pointing one of those dreaded AR-15s at me that I heard about on TV. If you think about it, if the gun is scary enough to scare a whole state legislature, if it's scary enough to scare the whole Democratic National Committee, it should be all that much more scary and intimidating to the intruder or any other violent person we might have to confront lawfully.
Well, and that's here. We've got to go to break, but I'd like to touch on that when we get back, because there's a couple of interesting factors there. Right now we're talking with Mass Ayub, and you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by LuckyGunner.com and Federal Premium Ammunition. They paid for this, so you don't have to. This segment brought to you by Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat, makers of the finest custom 1911s and scatterguns since 1977. A legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories, as well as the EDC X9L, 5-inch version of the X9, which offers discriminating shooters 1911 match-grade accuracy, superior ergonomics and concealability. With modern service pistol reliability and capacity, they've got 15 and 18-round flavors. At www.wilsoncombat.com. So we're talking with Mass Ayub. And so one of the things that we were discussing is how when you look at the actual research, the vast majority of defensive gun uses end in the display of a firearm, no shots fired, and that's what ends the encounter in a positive manner for the armed citizen. And you were discussing how if we carry along that thought, and someone enters into a home unlawfully and they are confronted by a homeowner that is armed with something that is culturally more frightening, that can have an impact on them. But to be clear, you're not saying that, you know, we're not necessarily planning on a psychological stop happening there. There are other advantages to selecting things like that, right?
There are. The AR-15, for example, in the home defense context. Historically, the person buying the household defense gun tends to be the alpha male of the family. It's one gender stereotype that unfortunately has been true, though we're seeing a change now. And often we'd see the man of the house bring home a full-size, you know, 14-inch pull stock, pump gun, 12-gauge magnum, and say, honey, I've done a lot of research, but here is the gun for you to use to protect the cubs. And you get a petite 5 foot tall female who has to lean back at the shoulders just to hold the darn thing up. Full power 12 gauge in a 7.5 pound shotgun is going to give you about the same recoil as 375 H&H Magnum and an 11 pound elephant rifle. And she fires the thing once and says, thank you, take it, stick it where the sun doesn't shine, and take a selfie so you can remember what you looked like when you were still sexually active.
Huh.
And she's going to be the last person to touch that gun in an emergency because she's literally become afraid of it. The AR-15 is essentially a very loud 22. The supposedly evil assault feature of the collapsing stock allows it in an instant to be adjusted to fit from the smallest to the largest member of the family who's authorized to use it. There's going to be much more confidence, and much more ability to shoot if they have to shoot. But more to the point, the personal confidence tends to project. John, one thing a whole lot of folks miss is that one definition of predator is expert in prey selection. All the criminals that I've arrested or interviewed in prison, none of them ever used the term body language, but all of them were familiar with it. They would describe that, you know, someone standing a certain way is weak, someone standing a certain way is strong. And confidence projects. And the easiest way to say it is if you know in your heart you can press that trigger if you have to and end a monster's life to save the lives of your own children, that monster is going to see that. In the end, as much as they try to make this or that gun intimidating, it's not the gun that they're scared of. The criminal world is an armed subculture itself. They're not afraid of firearms. What they're absolutely afraid of is a resolutely armed man or woman holding that gun at them. And that confidence historically does project. So it's more complicated and more multi-layered than it looks to the general public.
No, and that makes sense to me. So in your experience, self-defense shootings with you know, the AR-15, since that's what we're talking about specifically, those happen more frequently than maybe we would be given to think based off of what's reported, don't they? I mean, I can think of, as someone that studies this, 5 or 6 instances, but I know that this is an area that you are much more involved in than I am. So I was wondering if you could relay any relevant experience you might have as far as actual, you know, uses that have occurred.
Well, there's no central database that's empirically studying these. What we are seeing, of course, is the news clippings from around the country. And again, we're finding the AR-15 having been employed as a home defense weapon, simply because so many people have discovered this is a gun that everyone in the family can be comfortable with. Therefore, we're seeing them employed more. And what we are seeing is very often, as soon as the other guy sees the AR-15, he turns and runs. Now, sometimes they will turn and run when you point any sort of a weapon at them. In my life, the single guy I thought was most likely to force me to shoot him was looking at a 12-gauge Ithaca police riot gun that I was holding on him. And what we determined later, after he'd finally surrendered, was that in the primordial two-digit IQ depths of his mind, he figured because he had hidden his gun in his car that we weren't able to shoot him. And he finally realized, oh, crap, they don't know I've hidden my gun. And that was, I think, when he surrendered. The one guy that was most terrified, he was making little bleating noises like a sheep. I was pointing a 2-inch J-frame at him, but the reason was a moment before he thought he was breaking into an old man's home and was going to have an easy hit, and the next thing he knows, he's looking at a gun with the noses of the hollow points visible to him, and the guy's barking commands at him. And it's not the gun that scares them so much as it's the resolutely armed person. But all other things being equal, there's no doubt in my mind the AR, if it intimidates everyone else, is going to have some degree more intimidation value on the violent offender.
So are there any let me ask you this. Are there any factors that come into play as far as, because I know one of the things that's oftentimes discussed is, well, if you need to shoot someone, what you shoot someone with can matter. And I was curious if you could share your thoughts on that and, you know, the veracity of that, number one, and two, any other sort of mitigating things that can come into play there.
Well, in the court setting, it's certainly true. Many gun people are familiar with the Harold Fish case some years ago in Arizona. Fish was a retired high school teacher out hiking. Two large stray dogs came at him aggressively, and he fired a couple of warning shots, which frightened off the dogs. The dogs, unfortunately, were smarter than their owner. Their owner was a gentleman named Coonsley, who had been diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic, had gone off his meds and was probably decompensating, and it had a long history of violently attacking people. He was much younger, larger, and stronger than Mr. Fish, and he came charging at Mr. Fish, screaming threats at him. And when he was almost in touching distance, Fish had no choice. He shot the man three times, and the individual died. The prosecutor made a huge deal out of the fact that he was using a 10-millimeter pistol. And later, when jurors were interviewed, they had, after convicting Mr. Fish of manslaughter, one of them said that at first they had been very sympathetic toward Mr. Fish, but the use of what they called the 10-millimeter cannon, and they had also made a big deal out of he was using hollow-nosed dum-dum bullets, meant that it must have been malicious. I've been told that the prosecutor argued that the 10-millimeter was so powerful no police officer in Arizona would be permitted to carry it, which, if that was true, was either a blatant lie or a pathetic lack of research, because Maricopa County, the largest, you know, the county around Phoenix, the largest in the state, approved the 10-millimeter almost as soon as it came out, and I can show you officers today still carrying it there. And for a couple of years, every FBI agent in the state was issued the FBI Model 1076 10-millimeter. Finally, his gun had been loaded with the Federal Hydroshock 180 grain 10-millimeter ammunition, which is the load that was the reduced power load that was developed expressly for the FBI, and is roughly equivalent to ordinary 40 Smith & Wesson, which at the time of that trial was the most commonly carried gun and load in the state of Arizona. So can they bring that stuff up? Yeah, you bet. I've noticed Attorney Lisa Steele, probably our leading appellate lawyer who specializes in self-defense cases that went wrong at the trial level and ended up in a non-meritorious conviction. She's noted, I've noted, and others have noted that the private citizen using hollow point ammunition very frequently will face the argument from prosecutor or plaintiff's counsel that hollow-nosed dum-dum bullets, they always like to use that word, were indicia of malice, designed to rend and tear and cause additional pain and suffering, blah, blah. And if that is not explained by expert witnesses and by the defendant himself, a jury of ordinary people not educated in this sort of thing are vulnerable to that argument. So I would never say don't use hollow points. Quite the contrary, I'd say always use expanding bullets, but be able to explain it, and be able to explain it to 6 to 12 people who've been expressly selected by the other side for their lack of knowledge on the relevant topics.
Well, so let's pause right there, and then we'll get back into it because we have to go to break. Right now we're talking with Mass Ayoub. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by LuckyGunner.com and Federal Premium Ammunition. They paid for this, so you don't have to. This segment brought to you by BigTexOutdoors.com. BigTexOutdoors.com is the best place for you to find all of your everyday carry needs at the absolute best prices. Maybe you need all the lumens from Surefire at the lowest price? No problem. Spend too much time alone in your room and need an RMR in your carry gun now? Well, BigTexOutdoors.com understands and has those too. Glock accessories, yes. Fast, cheap shipping, 100% hassle-free returns, all that and more. And best of all, BigTexOutdoors.com has Ike. He's a good man and thorough. I like Ike. Everybody likes Ike. And you'll like Ike, too. Visit BigTexOutdoors.com today and find out what happens when every customer is a friend, not just an order. So we're talking with Mass Ayoub, and you were discussing indicia of malice, you know, the idea that people, you know, it's something that opposing counsel can use to show that you had malicious forethought ahead of time. And that's why you were making, you know, that's why someone's dead on the ground, is because you were out looking to kill someone. And as you were pointing out, you know, all of those things, all of the things that can be used against you in a trial setting, you just need to be able to articulate why you're making the choices that you're making, essentially, right?
Yeah, a whole lot of times, John, I can take off my shooting coach hat or my self-defense coach hat, put on a life coach hat, and find myself giving the same advice. In this case, don't do anything you can't explain, from the selection of the equipment to why you were in a certain place to how you handled it as you did, and be able to explain it, not to another martial artist from the dojo, not to another shooter from the gun club. Be able to explain it to your next-door neighbor who never owned a gun and hasn't been in a fight since grade school.
So, since we're talking about hollow points, and this will just be a good thing for anyone that's listening, the idea behind a hollow point, as far as why I might select that for personal protection, multiple different reasons. It actually allows me to shoot someone less because they are more effective. Because I've shot someone less, theoretically increases the chances that they survive, reduces the risk to bystanders, their risk of injury by hopefully limiting the probability of a shoot through on a target. There's multiple reasons why someone might select ammunition like that, right? And none of them are indicative of malice or malicious forethought. Yeah.
Correct. Those three reasons and one more, the fact that the because of the cookie cutter shape of the nose of the bullet, the hollow point is less likely to ricochet and endanger bystanders. All of those are the reasons that the expanding bullet has become universal standard issue in American law enforcement. Now, I would not want to be telling anybody to carry it because the police use it. That leaves you open to the false argument they used against George Zimmerman 7 years ago, wannabe cop. It's not that you use it because the police do. You use it for the exact same reasons the police do. The reduced likelihood to bystanders of the exiting bullet or the ricocheting bullet, the faster stop of the violent aggressor, which serves every innocent victim who's present in the course of the assault. And as you put it, the fact that he stops sooner means we can stop shooting him sooner, and inflicting fewer gunshot wounds, all other things being equal, should greatly enhance the likelihood of survival, even of the perpetrator himself. But we have to be able to explain that to a nation that only knows that, you know, newscasters and drama writers of TV shows refer to them as dumb bullets that are extra deadly and extra lethal. Again, be able to explain what you're doing and why you were doing it.
So if someone were to select an AR-15 for home defense, some of the reasoning behind that would be the ability to fit it to any shooter in the household, the greatly reduced recoil characteristics compared to other firearms that one might select for self-defense, the ability to be more accurate, because you've got more points of contact with the gun, which therefore limit the potential risk to everyone else in the home that you might be shooting around. Because that's something else that people don't seem to consider, is that if you're shooting someone inside your home, you know, hopefully you're alone. Hopefully it's just you there, and that makes the problem simpler. But very often the case that your loved ones are downrange, or are either you've got a crowded backstop, a crowded foreground, or perhaps even need to perform a rescue shot, right?
All of those things are entirely possible. And something that hits more precisely reduces what the law what the military calls corollary damage. And another thing we have to look at is your typical home defense shotgun will be a sporting style pump or perhaps semi-automatic with a four-shell magazine. If you have multiple home invaders, and we are seeing more cases now of a whole damn gang invading your house, not just one or two junkies, that gives you enough firepower to basically hold them off. Let's say you had a Joe Biden-approved double-barrel 12-gauge shotgun, and you have three perpetrators. That tells you right there that unless you can get them all lined up pretty close, your gun is going to be empty with at least one of them still standing.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be worse than that. Back when LAPD did their study, they found 58% hit potential with the 12-gauge shotgun. Now, LAPD has always been one of the most highly trained police departments in the country. They have always had excellent emphasis on firearms training in particular. And it's one of the few agencies that literally gives them a pay bonus for shooting extremely well on the monthly qualification courses. If people that skilled are only getting 58% hits with a shotgun, and you only have two shotgun shells to fire before they're on top of you, and you have three perpetrators, do the math, folks. The AR-15 is going to give you, if you have to shoot, is going to give you the chance to shoot enough to stay in the fight long enough to prevail against multiple opponents, and is going to let the multiple opponents realize that you can do it, and that probably increases the likelihood that they will abjure from the conflict, as the law likes to say, and turn around and leave instead of pressing the attack.
Well, and that's something, too. So I know that people listening, once again, so we can talk about typical and then we can talk about atypical. And as you said at the very beginning of the show, if we're in an event that involves a shot fired, we have already wandered into the atypical of the typical self-defense encounter with a gun, with the vast majority of self-defense encounters with a gun involving no shots fired at all. So let's say we've gotten to the point where a shot has now been fired. It's already a bad day for us, right? And so the next argument, and I'm not making the argument, I'm just highlighting what the argument would be, well, if you have a double barrel shotgun and you shoot one of them to the floor and your gun is now empty and there are two people that are left, well, they'll probably just leave. But that's not always the case, is it? Because there are plenty of reasons inside of an occupied structure where the dynamics of the encounter change for whatever reason, to where instead of people leaving the fight, they stay. And it might be something as simple as we've cut off their avenue of retreat unknowingly, right?
Well, it could be that. It could be quite simply seen from the front. It's quite apparent that a double-barrel shotgun only holds two rounds. And anyone who's seen anything from an Elmer Fudd and Bugs Bunny cartoon to anyone who's actually familiar with firearms knows that. Will recognize that you are now helpless with an empty gun and will almost certainly avenge their accomplice that you've shot down.
So whatever the reasoning is, I've been very lucky that I've gotten to speak to quite a few people that have been involved in armed altercations, either in an amateur capacity, against their will, or in a professional capacity. And I've yet to talk to any of them that have said that they would like to have less ammunition in their gun. Now, I've talked with plenty of them. I've talked with plenty of them that felt comfortable with the ammunition that they had, but none of them have ever said, I'd like to have less. And I can't help but think that that might be a clue, maybe. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Well, I totally agree with you. The other thing is question the statistics. Many years ago, back in the 70s and 80s, the mantra was that the average gunfight will be 2.3 rounds. And I, with two of our three largest departments, got a chance to talk to their lead firearms instructors. When I was taking the officer-involved shooting investigation class taught by the LAPD OIS unit in the mid-1980s, during Q&A, one of the other attending officers asked, what's the average number of shots fired by your officers here? And the answer was 2.4. And another officer raised his hand and said, how does that correlate with the case you just told us about where multiple officers of your department fired 49 shots and none of them hit the guy? And the instructor said, well, that was an aberration that was removed because it would skew the statistics. Another one said, what about the SLA shootout in which the police fired something on the order of 5,000 rounds? And he said, well, that was an atypical situation, an aberration of the norm, and therefore was removed so it would not skew the statistics. And translation, anything that looked bad was removed so it would not skew the statistics.
Huh.
The other coast, well, NYPD. I was there in a learning capacity and was told the average gunfight was 2.3 rounds per officer. And I said, okay, help me out with this, because you just told me that your hit potential is, you know, running 30 or so percent. That is, you know, 3 out of 10 shots fired connect with the bad guy somewhere. And you've told me you're winning 11 out of 12 gunfights with the current training. Guys, that does not add up to 2.3 rounds. And the answer I got was, we have firearms instructors, not statisticians.
Huh. Hold that thought.
And later I took...
I was going to say, hold that thought, because we've got to go to break, and then we'll pick right up on it. We're talking with Mass Ayoub. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by LuckyGunner.com and Federal Premium Ammunition. They paid for this, so you don't have to. And I'm sorry that I interrupted, Mass. You had left off on, were firearms instructors not statisticians? Please continue.
Well, first, basically, I went out and had a few drinks with one of their instructors, who I will never name because we were talking off the record, though he's retired now. And he pointed out that those statistics include all shots fired in the line of duty. It included putting a run-over crippled dog out of its misery, which generally would be one shot. It included accidental discharges, which generally would be one shot.
Well, hopefully would be one
shot. At that time, it even included suicides, which were generally one shot. And I said, so tell me exactly how you gather these stats. And we were sitting in a New York bar. He took a sip of his drink. He said, well, let's say right now a bad guy walked in with a gun in his hand and announced, this is a holdup. I pull my gun, show my badge, yell, police, drop your weapon. He fires at me a couple of times. I shoot at him a couple of times. He ducks over there. I duck over here. He shoots at me. I shoot at him a couple of times. He runs to the runs out the door. I chase him from the doorway. I shoot at him a couple more times and finally get him. What just happened? I said, high-volume running gunfight. And he took a sip of his beer and said, no, three examples of two shots apiece.
Huh.
So basically, a whole lot of statistics depend on what the person wants to show and how creative they might be in putting it together. And often it may be the supervisors above the cops who had a certain image and certain image they wanted to project, and these statistics were tailored accordingly.
So what you're saying is, I'm reminded of a quote, and the quote is, statistics are cold comfort if you find that you have been struck by lightning. And I want to say that was Cooper. But the point is that, so let's even say that those averages were representative. It's not a bad idea to stack the odds in your favor however you're able to.
Well, none of us gets up in the morning, counts out exactly how many dollars and cents we're going to need for lunch and parking, and leaves the rest of our pocket money on the night table. There aren't too many of us driving a car that doesn't have a spare tire. The whole reason we're carrying a gun is we are planning on being able to survive a contingency that might occur. It is statistically improbable that we will have that situation, but if we do have that situation, we will very desperately need the gun. As we said at the beginning, the use of the gun in self-defense is an aberration of the norm. To presume that our aberration of the statistical norm will be a statistically average aberration is to be altogether too hopeful and to invoke that great pop culture line, hope is not a strategy.
So along that line of thinking, or along that general line of questioning, is there any instances that stick out in your mind as far as either things that you've worked on or at least things that you're familiar with that were just completely beyond what people would consider normal, but I mean, they happen. Like, they happen. And I know that you highlighted some things, at the beginning of the show that were unlikely as far as distance goes, but is there anything else that sticks out in your mind after having done this for a while?
Well, there was one fellow who emptied a so-called high-capacity pistol, if I recall, a CZ-25, reloaded and emptied it again multiple times before he'd finally driven off the offenders. We see case after case in law enforcement where it's a multiple round count to put the offender down. In the recent Dayton atrocity, I haven't seen the autopsy, but I've been told the bad guy was hit 24 times. And during the course of that fusillade, was trying to get back up twice before they finally got enough lead in him to hold him down. Now, how many of those may have stopped in his body armor, I do not yet know. But the point is, it took that many bullets launched to stop the threat. And I believe all of those officers were firing with pistols. The single highest volume I'm aware of was approximately 106. And that goes back to Harry Beckwith's gun shop robbery in, I want to say, 1976.
Right.
And It's a phenomenon now and was a phenomenon then. A criminal gang would steal a couple of pickup trucks, ram one of them through the front of a gun shop, rush in, grab all the guns they could carry, throw them into the vehicle that hadn't been damaged, and drive away. And when this happened back then, the bad guys had the misfortune to pick a gun shop owned by a man who lived next door to the shop and had a Class 3 license. Harry's home, it's still there. It's still called Harry Beckwith's Gun Shop, though Harry himself passed several years ago. The Pickett family now runs it in McAnulty, Florida. Harry's place was kind of a hacienda, probably 80 or 100 yards from the shop, with a row of trees in between. And on this night, the shop has been closed up for hours, of course. He hears the crash of the truck going, into the building, looks out the window and sees what's happening. He told his wife to call the police and, get the cavalry on the way. Harry grabbed an M16, a bandolier of magazines, and a Smith & Wesson Model 76 submachine gun. Ran from his house to the cover of the trees in between and shouted a challenge, ordered them to drop their weapons. There were, if I recall, either five or six perpetrators in multiple vehicles. And they were stealing guns. You can imagine what they pointed at Harry. And Harry turned on the popcorn machine, emptied one of them, takes the other machine gun, the full machine gun, the M16, empties it, reloads, empties it, keeps going. And by the time the last of the bad guys were dead or fled, there were 106 rounds of empty grass on Harry's side of the fight. And basically, that's the highest volume by a single private citizen armed defender that I can think of offhand.
So,
armed defender.
Right. And I remember reading about that. I actually want to say I read your account of that, and I was hoping you would bring it up. So I'm kind of happy that you did.
Oh, feel free. Any of your listeners, do a Google search for Harry Beckwith shooting, and my article, and of course the news articles contemporaneous to the time, will come up.
Yeah.
I believe they also have it on the Harry Beckwith gun shop website.
Yeah, I would imagine so. It's kind of just an interesting little historical artifact. So out of curiosity, and we've only got about 3-4 minutes left, but since we're talking about this shooting, so that's a shooting that a lot of people would look at and go, oh my God, how could he have ever justified that in court? But I can assume, because I never read anything to the contrary, that that was considered a perfectly legally justifiable shooting, right?
Well, it did go in front of the grand jury. Now, Micanopy is adjacent to Gainesville, which then, more so now, but even then, was kind of a blue island in a very red state. However, it's also in Alachua County, which still has old conservative values. And I would imagine when the grand jury convened, being drawn from the county jury pool, that there was more red than blue. But the grand jury found no problem with it whatsoever. And we're probably kind of surprised that Harry letting them live.
Yeah.
But interesting thing, I have found with Class 3 weapons, every case I've found of a private citizen using a legal Class 3 weapon, it has minimum gone to the grand jury and sometimes to trial. We know how many gun owners are surprised to find out you can legally own a machine gun or a silencer in most jurisdictions. Imagine how that resonates with the jury pool who doesn't know that. So it will draw extra heat on you. Where I would see it happening more likely today would be the suppressor, which makes enormous sense in a home defense gun. But I have not yet found a case of a private citizen using a suppressor in self-defense.
Well, and that's kind of...
We do know.
I was going to say, and you said it makes a lot of sense, but like that does make a massive amount of sense, because if you're reacting to armed people breaking into your home, permanent hearing loss is not necessarily something that I'd like to be contending with after the fact. If it's something that I'll deal with it if I have to, but if I could have a gun that does not cause that, that would be kind of beneficial, right?
I would think so. Failing that, I would hope most of the listeners to this particular dedicated program would own active hearing protectors. Instead of keeping them in your sporting equipment bag or in the car, I keep mine by the bed.
Right.
If I've got time to grab a shotgun, I've certainly got time to slap those on. The higher-end models like the Command Industries and the old Gentex Wolf ears, which sadly we can't get anymore, amplify small sounds. You can literally hear a foot on a carpet, but they reduce the loud sounds, and it's a tremendous tactical advantage. It takes only an instant to throw them on. And the bonus is, if you confront anybody when you're pointing a gun at them and are wearing earmuffs, they know you're serious.
Yeah, right. Well, so, Mass, if people want to train with you, where can they do that at? Because we are coming up on the end of the show.
Sure. We teach all over the country, John. It's MassadAyoubGroup.com. That's MassadAyoubGroup.com. Most of our training is geared for the law-abiding private citizen who keeps or carries a firearm for self-defense.
Well, thanks so much for giving us your time today. I certainly appreciate it. And thanks for
Thank you, John.
Go ahead.
Thank you, and thank you and your guests for all the good that you've been doing.
Well, I was going to say, on a personal note, thank you for all the help that you've given me throughout the years. I've certainly appreciated that. You have certainly been very kind in your time. So I appreciate that as well. But give my best to Gail, and hopefully I'll talk to you soon, man.
Will do. Take care, brother.
All right. Hey, make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio, and keep leaving those 5-star review on iTunes. Really appreciate it. It helps us out. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe. See you next week.